Welcome to the Moose Room. Brad Hines is here today. Emily is off again doing lots of extension related farm safety and mental health extension events today. So she's been quite busy this fall. But we have some guests here today from the University of Maine, Juan Romero and Glenda Pereira. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me in your podcast, Brad.
Juan is an associate professor of forage science and dairy cattle nutrition at the University of Maine, where he looks at forage quality, forage conservation, and looking at how those forage practices really can be translated into farmers. And then everybody knows Glenda.
Unfortunately, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
I don't know. She's been on the podcast many times. We all know her as my former graduate student that worked a lot here at Morris, but is now in the University of Maine in a dairy extension role and is doing quite well.
Yeah, and Juan and I, we're a package deal. So Juan and I worked closely together on almost all of our projects.
Very good. Glenda also has a podcast in Maine, so we can shout out the Maine Farmcast, and we'll put the notes to that in the links. And you might get some perspectives on what's happening in the Northeast as well from, you know, farm podcasts. They don't specialize. I saw some horse podcasts, yeah. Things like that. So you never know what you might get there.
Yeah.
Anyways, but we have two super secret questions for just our guests. Glenda knows we won't.
My tally's already in there. Yeah.
That's right. We'll give you a pass today. So Juan, what is your favorite breed of beef cattle?
Oh, beef. Oh, that's an interesting question. So I would say, I don't want to be sound boring, but I guess Angus, you know, like, it has such a nice meat quality, so nice marbling.
Angus it is. I'll run down the tallies quick for our listeners, for those of you that are curious. So Black Angus still in first place with 18 now. Hereford in second with 13. Black Baldy, 5. Scottish Highlander, 5. Charlet, 4. Red Angus, 4. Shorthorn, 3. Semental, 2. Belted Galloway, 2, Brahma, 2, and many with number 1. Stabilizer, Galvey, Kenia, Nelore, Jersey, Belgian Blue, Brangus, Piedmontese, White Park, and Miniature Scottish Highlander. So we have a wide range of beef breeds with our
guests. I should have answered Brangus, because actually for my master's, I work with Brangus. So I recall that. So it's a very a specific breed that is in the Southeast, right? So it's, I'm not even sure if it's classified officially as a breed.
It is. In the South, yeah. Some states, yes. But, Texas has a lot of Brangus.
Yeah, Florida, I work a lot on that. So I did a hay project. So I was like assessing like ammoniation versus enzymes on the performance of beef cattle. So, and I use Brangus.
Well, the second question is probably a little bit easier. So what is your favorite dairy breed?
Yes, that's a good question.
There's only one right answer, Juan.
So
that's right.
For the U.S. context, I would say Holstein, right? So like, that's great.
Wrong. That's wrong.
But my grandparents, you know, they used to have a dairy in Peru. So my grandfather, he won awards with Brown Swiss. So yes. So I would say that, I don't know, like, of course, you know, for the U.S. context, Holstein, but they say for my Peruvian context, Brown Swiss would be my choice.
Okay, well, we will accept Brown Swiss.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm a Jersey guy, so any...
Oh, the Jerseys wouldn't... it's because of the altitude. The altitude is key in Peru. There are a bunch of dairies in the highlands, so... And the altitude is a big issue, you know. That is why we cannot have Holsteins in the mountains. So they tend to have, like, heart problems, and they don't perform very well. Yes.
Okay, so our dairy breeds, let's run down quick. Holstein still in the lead with 24. Jersey, 20. So we're gaining. Brown Swiss keeps increasing. We've had a few weeks of Brown Swiss guests, so that's always good. They're at 13. Montbéliard at 3. Dutch Belt at 3. Guernsey, 3. Ayrshire, 3. Milking Shorthorn, 2. And Normandy, 2. But today we really wanted to get into learning about forages and clover production. So a while ago, Juan and I have worked on a project with Andre Brito at the University of New Hampshire, where it was all about trying to increase clovers in forage diets, especially grazing cattle diets. And Juan was working on some of those aspects, looking at clover production, especially in how to preserve it and grow it, things like that. So let's tell us a little, Juan, about the project and your involvement.
Oh, yes. So basically the project, the overall scope was to increase the utilization of legumes in dairy systems across the northern regions of the U.S. So and my component specifically was to deal with the storage and the concerns that were raised regarding red clover phytoestrogen levels. So because specifically in New England, so and to a great extent in the Northeast, so our soils are not like super well suited for alfalfa, right? Red clover is more a natural choice for us because of the soil pH, because of our issues with soil drainage. So red clover is a more natural choice. So and then consequently the what we wanted to assess was to see what were the effects of different harvest management practices on the phytoestrogen levels. So in that way, we could basically provide with producers tools to make decisions in terms of if they wanted phytoestrogens or not, to be able to manipulate that. Because phytoestrogens, actually, they have two sides. So they have a negative side on reproduction that is well described. But recently, there has been positive examples in terms of taking advantage of phytoestrogens in beef cattle fed, for instance, stall fescue infected with endophytes. So red clover has proven to be a solution in those contexts, right? So that is why I think that, I mean, what we found has a wide set of applications depending on how you want to, if you want to increase or decrease the phytoestrogens, depending on what problem you want to tackle.
So we should talk a little bit about phytoestrogens. And for our listeners, what phytoestrogens basically are, it's a natural compound in plants sort of mimicking estrogen. It's been sort of shown to decrease fertility in livestock. Probably that's the biggest factor is, you know, it can cause crazy heat cycles, low infertility. Some people might have heard of what they call clover disease. So it we see it probably more in red clovers, but maybe so in dairy cattle, it might not be a big issue. So I think we're trying to look at the phytoestrogens, and I know you were looking at those, but that's sort of what we're thinking about and how to maybe reduce some of the phytoestrogens in these plants, or so it doesn't affect dairy cattle.
Yes, I mean, these can go either way. Like I said, these compounds, they... No, in the past, they were perceived only as negative, but now we can see their positive side, just like tannins, right? So in the past, they were negatively perceived, and then as we improve our ability to be able to measure them and also to understand their impact on the animal, that we can develop applications in certain settings where you can take advantage of them. So yeah, same thing. That's what I see with this issue with the phytoestrogens. And red clover is the one that has the highest. So I was like completely amazed when I saw for the first time that red clover has up to, can have more than 1% phytoestrogens on a dry matter basis. Like, wow, that's quite high. So, and some of the European literature indicates that once you go above 1% concentration of phytoestrogens, so consume as part of the total diet, that's when you see the negative effects on animals. So between 1 to 2%. So meaning that, so it's much less likely to perceive these problems if you are feeding something else besides a red clover, right? Which is going to be most of the situation. So this is going to be really The negative sides are going to be mainly for the people that for some reason they are only feeding red clover, so which is very unlikely in extreme scenario, or maybe some people grazing. So, but that's not going to be what is typical, right? So once we start basically having the TMRs or having supplements, then that problem is not going to be as great, right? So, and then basically the idea is to start exploring the potential benefits. There are some research that has been conducted by the USDA where the phytoestrogens of red clover have been reported to, for instance, help with heat stress. So so there are some interesting angles developing that I hope in the future we can have more of that so we can help producers.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the studies you've done. So we basically, at least what we were harvesting was red clover silage, right? And what sort of percentage of red clover was in the forage that you were harvesting? Was it half, 50%, or what sort of percentage of red clover, you know? And because trying to think about farmers and wanting to plant the red clover, you know, how much red clover do we put in the ration, or what's sort of the optimum? Some people might put a little, some might put a lot. What did you find, and how did you go about doing the red clover in the rest of the forage?
So because basically the objective as part of a team that was I was assigned, it was to answer the effects of hay and silage of phytoestrogens. Basically what we assessed was a pure stand of red clover. So because there were other components in the ground that other people that were doing the feeding aspects, like Andre, for instance, right? I know he was doing the feeding aspects. So, but it, specifically in the experiment that we conducted in Maine was a pure stand of red clover, and we selected Freedom, which is one of these basically new cultivars that were developed to have thin stems and not trichomes, so they red clover can be more suited for hay production. So, and we have no issues producing hay of that red clover in Maine. So. So, which is great compared to the traditional red clovers that are thick and have these trichomes and very hard to dry. I mean, red clover among the legumes is they're the slowest to cure. So, but this one was curing very nicely, very thin stems, no trichomes. So, so we were able not only to do silage, but also we did hay out of the red clover in the experiment. So we did everything in a single experiment. So we assess in the same field and the same harvest, so hay that was amply cured. So I'm talking about 88% dry matter. So we cure it actually more than what we wanted, but that's why I'm calling it like that, ample curing, insufficient curing. So we had a hay that was baled around 70% dry matter. So to see the effects of not properly curing the hay. And also we have silage that was insufficiently wilted, which was basically around 29% dry matter. So which is actually something that in New England, we see a lot of silages, like most of the silages I see for grass and legumes are below 30% dry matter. So it's very hard to see anybody wilting above 30% in this region because of the weather. Some other practices, right? But and then we have the ample cure silage, which was at 45% dry matter. So, and then we have two storage times. So we basically wanted to have a measurement if somebody wanted to open the silo a couple of weeks after installing, which happens in small producers especially. So they cannot wait and they open their silos almost as fast as they put them in. So, and then we have that properly stored with more than 3 months storage.
Sure. Well, I'm interested in some of the hay as well. So that was dry hay?
Yeah.
So how long does it take to dry red clover hay, or how long did you let it set to be able to get that dry? I think that's important.
So in our case, it took 5 days. So, but it was not because of red clover. This experiment was not to assess how fast Freedom was curing. It just happened that during those days, basically, the weather was not super conducive and it took longer. I think if we had been sunny and shiny, we would have been able to to be able to bill it in 4 or as short as 3 days.
So you have hay, then you have silage at 29% dry matter, and then you have some cured stuff. So which one had the best forage quality, or how did we assess forage quality with these three comparisons?
So I would say that the cured silage was, you know, a very well-rounded option. So because basically by curing, we observe we are preserving more of the sugars, so more of the protein quality. So compared to the wet silage, which, you know, like because it was wet, the protein quality degraded faster. So there was more ammonia production. So there was a loss of the quality component of the protein there. With a cured silage, you have to be very careful. That's what we found. So you have to wait for it to ensile properly. So that's one of the things that we observed. For the hay, it's easy because, I mean, the wet hay just went, like, that was the worst one. So when hay is not properly cured, like, the quality goes down the drain, like, way more than even the wet silage.
And I remember, Juan, you stating that when people are baling and wrapping, so you just mentioned that, they need to wrap at least 7 layers. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So that will be the minimum number of layers that you should be using to wrap these balages. Yes, because they have a lot of surface area. So if they're not properly wrapped, they're going to go downhill very fast because the oxygen will percolate into the bale. Those bales are not necessarily super packed, especially if you are baling with an older machine. So the density is not going to be super high. So then proper wrapping is very important.
Well, I think that's very interesting results that you found. And there's a lot of people that are very into forage quality, but there's also the practical standpoint, and we're guilty of it as well, that sometimes we open silage way too early. It happens in more places than you know. You know, it's like, oh man, well, we're out of feed. We'll maybe try and get this 2 weeks of curing, but we need to open it because we're out of feed and we need to feed cows. But it's important to know that you're going to have some heating and probably forage quality loss if you do that. That's an important result as well.
Yep.
Yeah, I think, I like Brad said, I think you make some really good points. So farmers who want to use inoculants, but they always tap into their feed source before 60 days, maybe they forego use of inoculants because they are breaking into whatever feed source they're needing within 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So that could be a potential, way to save costs because inoculants can be expensive. But additionally, like we mentioned, so if you know that you're going to have to tap into that corn silage bunk or bag or whatever earlier, be aware that your like starch availability isn't going to be as great. So work with your nutritionist or whoever is helping you to address these feeding strategies to say, well, hey, we know we're opening in 2 weeks, so we need to make sure that the starch content in our grain is going to match the reduced starch content in our corn silage. And so kind of these results were really important because we're understanding how we can mitigate and which strategies will still help our cows maintain the production and maintenance needs that they have. So yeah, these are really, these results lead to good practical solutions. And it's just really being aware of those changes and how they're going to impact production, right? I mean, if we have good records, we'll be able to see that, you know, well, hey, we tapped into that corn silage bag that was 2 weeks. And you know, we saw this result because we didn't address it or whatever. So I think this was still really helpful.
Yes, it's a big challenge to basically provide recommendations to open silos early, you know, like talking about less than a month, so, or a few weeks after ensiling. So it is a challenge. So if I am pushed against the wall and forced to give an answer, okay, what can I do if I have to do it? So if you were to open the silo earlier, so the benefits of the hemolactic inoculant would have been already manifested, right? But that doesn't solve the issue of aerobic stability, which is a completely different thing, right? That's like the heating once you open. So that is going to be hard to address if you open in less than a month.
So let's talk about the phytoestrogens. Part of the project was to look at phytoestrogens and do these methods of preservation lower phytoestrogens or perhaps increase them. What did we find?
So the strongest effect and one of the most important messages of this project is that curing decreases phytoestrogens. So the more you cure, the less phytoestrogens that forage crop is going to have. So especially if you compare hay versus silage, there is a huge difference. So if you want to basically have the lowest phytoestrogens possible, then you make hay. Or hay is going to have that advantage of having less phytoestrogens. And let's keep in mind that basically all legumes have phytoestrogens. So it's not, the red clover has a bunch of them, but alfalfa also has phytoestrogens too.
Talk about phytoestrogens, and we even see them in alfalfa. What is the comparison of phytoestrogens in red clover versus alfalfa? Is it less? Is it more?
Oh, so alfalfa has way less phytoestrogens than red clover. Like I was mentioning you, red clover is like 1%, and you can go as high as 2%. For alfalfa, I cannot recall from the top of my head, but I think it's less than 0.3%, but I don't quote me on that. I just don't recall because we didn't work with alfalfa. So alfalfa also has different phytoestrogens. It's not, they're not the same ones.
Right. So really curing silage, letting it ferment and store for a long period of time, longer than 2 weeks or more, you know, 3 months, will reduce phytoestrogens. And you have better forage quality. So that's probably a good thing to make sure that people do is store your forage longer if you can, because there's many benefits to that. Okay, I think we've learned a lot today, learned a lot about storage of clover, forage quality, and a little bit about phytoestrogens. So store your forage as long as you can, and you'll have maximum forage quality and lower phytoestrogens. Okay, well, I think we'll wrap it there. We thank you for joining us today, Juan and Glenda. We look forward to hearing from you again about some of your work into the future. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Glenda. Thanks.
And with that, we'll wrap it here. So if you have any comments, questions, or scathing rebuttals, feel free to contact Emily. She can handle all the correspondence.
Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next episode.
Rummaging through the rumen, venturing across the abomasum, roving through the reticulum, meandering about the omasum, moving through the mouth, exiting through the esophagus.